Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Balabha Giribhara Dhari Jana Balabha Giribhara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Banachari Yamuna Tira Banachari Gopi Jana Balabha Giribhara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Balabha Giribhara Dhari Gopi Jana Balabha Giribhara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Banachari Yamuna Tira Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya
Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Shishi Panchatattva Ki Jai Shishi Radha Madhavarasta Saki Brinda Ki Jai Go Premanandi. Okay. So Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I wasn't given a specific verse to talk on. I picked out one verse from the second chapter of the 10th canto. This is the same chapter that Maharaj spoke from, Prayers by the Demigods. But the verse I picked was number 35, which obviously we don't have written up. I'm just going to read that through. It has a fairly long purport, which I may or may not get all the way through. So I'll just read the Sanskrit and then we'll do the translation. So this is text 35. Satvam nachadharto idam nijam bhaved vijnanam ajnanam bidapamarjanaha Guna prakarsha anumiyate bhavan prakashate yasya chajena vaguna. O Lord, cause of all causes, if your transcendental body were not beyond the modes of material nature, one could not understand the difference between matter and transcendence. Only by your presence can one understand the transcendental nature of your lordship, who are the controller of material nature. Your transcendental nature is very difficult to understand unless one is influenced by the presence of your transcendental form. Nice verse. So in the purport there, I'll read a little bit. It says, Prabhupada says, it is said trigunya vishaya veda nistrigunyo bhavarjana. Unless one is situated in transcendence, one cannot understand the transcendental nature of the Lord, as it's stated in the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 14, verse 29. Atapite deva padambaja dvaya prasada leshanu grihita evahi. Janati tatvam bhagavan mahim no nachanyam ekopi charam vichinvan. Only by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead can one understand him. Those who are in the modes of material nature, although speculating for thousands of years, cannot understand him. The Lord has innumerable forms, Ramadi Murtishu Kalani Amena Tishtan. And unless these forms, such as Lord Ramachandra, Nisringadev, Krishna and Balaram, were transcendental, how could they be worshipped by devotees since time immemorial? Bhakchamam abhijanati yavanyaschasmi tatvata. Devotees who awaken their transcendental nature in the presence of the Lord and who follow the rules and regulations of devotional service can understand Lord Krishna, Lord Ramachandra, and other incarnations who are not of this material world, but who come from the spiritual world for the benefit of the people in general. If one does not take to this process, one imagines or manufactures some form of God according to material qualities, and can never awaken a real understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The words Bhakcha Mam Abhijanati Yavanyas Chasmi Tatvata, signify that unless one worships the Lord according to the regulative devotional principles, one cannot awaken the transcendental nature. Deity worship, even in the absence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, awakens the transcendental nature of the devotee, who thus becomes increasingly attached to the Lord's lotus feet. The appearance of Krishna is the answer to all imaginative iconography of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everybody imagines the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead according to his mode of material nature. In the Brahma Samhita, it is said that the Lord is the oldest person. Therefore, a section of religionists imagine that God must be very old, and therefore they depict the form of the Lord as a very old man. But in the same Brahma Samhita, that is contradicted. Although he is the oldest of all living entities, he has his eternal form as a fresh youth. The exact words used in this connection in the Bhagavatam are vijnanam ajnanam vidapamarjanam. Vijnana means transcendental knowledge of the personality of Godhead. Vijnanam is also experience knowledge. So transcendental knowledge has to be accepted by the descending process of disciplic succession, as Brahma presents the knowledge of Krishna in the Brahma Samhita. Brahma Samhita is vijnana, or realized by Brahma's transcendental experience. And in that way, he presented the form and the pastimes of Krishna in the transcendental abode. Ajnana Bida means that which can match all kinds of speculation. In ignorance, people are imagining the form of the Lord. Sometimes he has no form, and sometimes he has form, according to their different imaginations. But the presentation of Krishna in the Brahma Samhita is vijnana, scientific, experience knowledge given by Lord Brahma and accepted by Lord Chaitanya. There is no doubt about it. Sri Krishna's form, Sri Krishna's flute, Krishna's color, everything is reality. Here it is said this vijnanam is always defeating all kinds of speculative knowledge. Therefore, the demigods prayed, without your appearing as Krishna, as you are, neither ajnana bida, or the nescience of speculative knowledge, nor vijnanam would be realized. Ajnana bida pamarjanam. By your appearance, the speculative knowledge of ignorance will be vanquished, and the real experienced knowledge of authorities like Lord Brahma will be established. Men influenced by the three modes of material nature imagine their own God according to the modes of material nature. So in this way, God is presented in various ways, but your appearance will establish what the real form of God actually is. So that's about half of the purport. Just a few comments on that. The real point being there, that if the Lord does not continually assert his presence within the so-called material world, then there's no comparative by which a person can understand him. If the Lord doesn't appear, if he doesn't exhibit his true form, then how will a person know what is transcendental and what is not? All he has as a reference point is whatever is born in his own mind from contact with the three modes of material nature. And therefore, all kinds of speculation arises from people who do not know or do not recognize the actual form of the Lord. Prabhupada gives the example here of the old man with the beard. We've all probably seen that painting. I think it's on the ceiling in the Sistine Chapel in Rome, where God is supposed to be reaching out with his finger, is an old man with a big bushy beard. So this is an imagination based on the idea that God is the oldest person. But that description of Krishna as the oldest person is just meant to indicate that he is the original person. Yeah. He was there before everybody else was. It doesn't mean that he's old in the sense of deterioration due to the effects of time. That his body is somehow or another subject to the modes of nature and the mixing of the influence of time. Everybody else has that, and that's our conception of oldest. So therefore they make this invention. Or sometimes people think that, or because they have no understanding of the actual presence of God, the appearance of God, then they think that he must not have any personal form. He must be some kind of impersonal force. The Mayavadis also are thinking like that. Or that he's just some mythological figure. That even when they're informed about Krishna's appearance, they don't believe that he actually is a person. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's mentioned there that a Mahatma is a person who is continually glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But in the modern age, we have experience of a so-called Mahatma who said that if Krishna is a real person, I will give up my position as a Hindu. No need to mention who that was. But this is the problem. Yeah, if Krishna is a person, I will give up my position as a Hindu. Why would he say that? Because he has no actual vigyan or knowledge. The same person said very openly that I never go to any holy place because I don't believe that they have any effect on the consciousness. I think it's all a myth that you can go and bathe in the Ganges or the Jamuna and get some actual benefit. So his whole life, he never went to any holy place. So this is a problem. Yeah, and this is one of the leaders of society. And there are many such personalities. And of course, his advantage from denying the personality of Godhead is that then he doesn't have to follow his instructions. If you pretend that he doesn't really exist, then whatever words he has spoken are open to reinterpretation. The words of the Bhagavad Gita are no longer Krishna's because Krishna doesn't exist. Now they can be molded and manipulated to forward my own particular philosophy and theory of politics or sociology or, you know, whatever else it may be. When Krishna, you know, is described as being there at the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Kurukshetra is no longer an actual place. Krishna is no longer an actual person. And therefore, whatever he says can be manipulated according to one's own desire. And therefore, you know, the satyagrahi, the person who is supposed to be chasing after truth, is deliberately avoiding it, the supreme truth, so that he can establish his own ideas. This is the problem. So Kurukshetra becomes the field of activities, the five Pandavas become the five senses, blah, blah, blah. And all advantage, all understanding of the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord is finished by such speculative ideas. In 1973, when Prabhupada visited Australia, the devotees made up a poster. It showed the side profile of Srila Prabhupada that we have on the Back to Godhead masthead. And then above it, it said, "He sees God." It was a very bold poster. We plastered it all over Melbourne and Sydney. Yeah, "He sees God." It was a challenge. That yes, God actually exists and he can actually be seen. Yeah, sometimes if you talk with somebody and you're trying to convince them that God exists, they ask you, "Well, have you actually seen him?" It's a challenge because they don't believe that you can actually see God. Yeah. So Prabhupada, because he could see God, he was seeing God, he could present Krishna in such a way that we understood he's real. Not some mythology, not some imagination, you know, but actually a person, but a transcendental person. a person unlike any other person that we've met within our own experience, but a supreme person nonetheless. Prabhupada was able to convince us of that. Why? Because he sees God. He actually had vigyan. He had realized knowledge, not just some speculative interpretation, you know, caused by passion and ignorance or even goodness. The following year, when Prabhupada was in Melbourne, a couple of young men came. I think they might have been reporters, I don't remember. So Prabhupada was preaching to them, and so at one point, one of them asked the same question. Have you actually seen God, or do you actually see God? So Prabhupada waited for a moment, and then he said, if I tell you, will you accept my answer? So then they were a little submissive, so they both said, yes, we will. So then Prabhupada said, then yes, I am seeing Krishna at every moment. So that was Srila Prabhupada, vigyan. This is described here, ajnana bida, that which can match all speculations. That when the truth is presented, all the speculative ideas are all shot down. That's all. They're all dissolved and eradicated by the appearance of the truth. Just as when the sun comes up in the morning, all the ghosts and hobgoblins that haunt people's minds in the darkness are immediately eradicated. You don't have to do anything special, ghost busting or anything else. You just see the light that is Krishna, and then immediately everything else is finished. That was what was Prabhupada was presenting, Krishna Surya Sama. Yeah, my higher adhikar. That if you want to be freed from this speculative realm of imagination and ghosts, then you just see the light, that's all. You see the Son of Krishna. It's presented here. And therefore, the demigods are saying exactly the same thing. Your transcendental nature is very difficult to understand unless one is influenced by the presence of your transcendental form. So although Krishna is everywhere, is in everything, is without everything, is in every atom, is between every atom, we don't see him. That's the problem. And we forget, even when Krishna does appear, due to the influence of time, then people tend to forget. There's one book that was written in the 17th century by a mathematician and theologian, Christian theologian, called Craig. It's called the Theologiae Christianae Principia Mathematica, the principles of mathematics as applied to the theology of Christianity. So he, whatever formula he used, I don't know, I didn't look into it in detail, but he used a mathematical formula by which he worked out that if the New Testament had not been written, because that's, you know, the story of Jesus, if that had not been written, then his estimation was, but by the year 800, that's just 800 years after his birth, then Jesus would have just been a mythology, and not a real person anymore, but he would have just been considered a figment of people's imaginations. But because the New Testament was actually written down, his activities were actually described, his personal interactions and deeds were committed to, you know, some form of preservation, writing. Then his estimation was that then therefore he would still be considered a real person at least up until the year 3150. As I say, I don't know exactly what formula he was using, but it's some kind of mathematical calculation applied to theology. So 3150. So if at least writing down Jesus's activities could preserve the reality of his personality for 3000 years, now we're looking at 5000 years since the appearance of Krishna. So we're well beyond what he calculated, would be, you know, the normal course of understanding and accepting of God, you know, as a real person. Now we're 5,000 years. And of course, we only have to look back about 600 years to Vrindavan. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went there, nothing was apparent, or hardly anything. There was hardly any remembrance of Krishna whatsoever. He went out into a field, there was a small puddle of water. He immediately was in ecstasy and bathed in that because he recognized this is Radhakund. Radhakund is, you know, the topmost place, manifest place of Krishna's pastimes, but it had become a puddle of water. And therefore, he sent his disciples to live in Vrindavan and resurrect all the transcendental places of Krishna's activities and appearance and his leelas. Nowadays, if we go there, you can go on Brajmandala Parikrama, you can visit all the different places that are described there in the 10th canto where Krishna did all of his different activities and leelas. That's because the six Goswamis had vijnan. They realized the presence of the Supreme Lord, the personality of the Supreme Lord, and they wrote it down. They made a record of it and presented that in disciplic line. So one after another, then Krishna's presence, the reality of his personality is preserved by the pure devotees who are themselves on the transcendental platform. But if one is not on the transcendental platform, there's no question of understanding who God is, what he actually does, what is his address. Prabhupada sometimes would say that. Another occasion, again in Melbourne, somebody challenged Srila Prabhupada, what is your conception of God? So Prabhupada threw it straight back at him. He said, well, what is your conception of God? So he said, well, God is God. He said, no, you say, what is God? No, God is God. No, you say it, what is God? You say God, now what is God? Well, I don't know, but God is God. So then Prabhupada said, we know who is God. We know his name. We know his address. We know his telephone number. We know his associates and we know his activities. That was the difference, and that is the difference between Krishna consciousness and ordinary religious processes. Sometimes people ask, what is the difference? Why I can follow this path or that path? They all lead the same way. No, sorry, they don't. Unless you come to the point of understanding the personality of Godhead and accept his transcendental nature and activities and pastimes, they have to be realized. And it's not that because, you know, we're separated, let's say, 5,000 years from the time that we read when Krishna appeared, that his presence is not imminent. His presence can be realized at any moment, at any time, because Krishna himself is the master of time. He is beyond the influence of time. He is permanent and eternal. And that means that in any moment, Krishna can be understood and immediately realized. So even if we read and we don't have a realization, still, Krishna say, Prabhupada says here, deity worship, even in the absence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, awakens the transcendental nature of the devotee, who thus becomes increasingly attached to the Lord's lotus feet. Therefore, Prabhupada availed us of that opportunity as much as possible. I've been reading some of his letters, actually all of them. I'm trying. I started at 1965. I'm up to 1970 now. So around about 1968, when Prabhupada started to initiate a few devotees in second initiation, giving them the Gayatri Mantra and the sacred thread, he immediately started to think about establishing deities all around the world. At that point, he had about 5 temples in North America. The devotees had not quite got to England at that point, or Germany, where Shivananda went. They were just there in America, a few temples, but Prabhupada was already writing to rich men that he knew in India that I want you to donate so many sets of Radha Krishna deities. It was a revolutionary thing that Prabhupada did. Nobody actually had ever done that before, and establishing genuine deity worship to a high level anywhere in the West or anywhere outside of India. And even in India, people don't really understand who the deity is, most people. They think it's just some idol, just some vehicle through which you offer, you know, your prayers, and that goes to, you know, some unborn, all-pervasive nothingness with which you want to merge at the end of this life. But Prabhupada actually induced Krishna to appear in places, you know, in the middle of the most unqualified personalities who had no real qualification whatsoever for worshipping him. But Prabhupada actually established Radha Krishna worship all over the world. He had a very deliberate plan for doing that because, as he says, even if the Supreme Lord is not personally present before us, by worshipping the deity, it's transcendental, and it brings us to a transcendental platform by which one can understand that the deity is none different from the Supreme Lord himself. So deity worship was a very important part of Prabhupada's plan. He was spreading the holy name, but he wanted this Pancharatriki Vidhi also because it's practical. Yeah, people can speculate in various ways, even if they're becoming devotees, about chanting, about preaching, different methodologies. But on the point of worshipping the deities, you cannot speculate. It's very strictly regulated. Rules and regulations are there, Pancharatriki Vidhi, and one has to follow that. And if one does so, it is Krishna's promise that he will reciprocate with that devotee. Yeah, if one seriously follows the standards that have been given by the previous acharyas, then it's as good as them doing it. Yeah. Sometimes we question, well, if we're not on the pure platform. But if you follow the rules and regulations, if we practice what we've been told strictly, then actually we are on the pure platform. I once asked Prabhupada that question. There was an issue that had come up about one of Prabhupada's disciples who had kind of split away from ISKCON, and he was building up his own following. So he was being criticized for that, you know, Prabhupada's the pure devotee. Anybody that comes along should be brought to him for, you know, initiation. And this man was attracting his own following. So Prabhupada was not that concerned. He said as long as he's preaching this proper standard, then it's fine. So later on, I was thinking about it. So I was in Prabhupada's room and I asked him that, don't you have to be a pure devotee, you know, to have your own disciples? So Prabhupada said, pure means chanting 16 rounds and following the four regulative principles. Bas. Yeah. Now, to what degree of purity and realization one has, that's another question. But pure platform means the rules and regulations of Sadhana Bhakti. And if one is following that, one is on the transcendental platform. And then it's only a question of time and practice before the heart becomes completely purified and Krishna will appear before such a devotee personally. A purified devotee then becomes eligible by the demonstration of his faith in the previous acharyas, that qualifies him for a personal darshan with Krishna. That platform, of course, comes after some time, but that's how it happens. Krishna makes himself available through a certain system, and if we follow that without speculating, without concoction, then this personal appearance, as the demigods are saying here, that is absolutely necessary, immediately comes about. And then at that point, then of course, one makes very rapid advancement into the higher realms of exchange with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this vijnana then, realized knowledge, is a must, because Prabhupada was actually seeing Krishna at every moment. Therefore, he could actually make Krishna appear before our eyes. Yeah. What to speak about, you know, being in the modes of material nature. The people that Prabhupada was dealing with were barely out of the mode of ignorance. There was no question of goodness. Some passion was there. So what hope did they have of understanding anything about the transcendental Supreme Lord? But Prabhupada was able to manifest the Supreme Personality of Godhead through his words and through his example and actions, by his own pure devotion. And that had an immediate effect. Yeah, because he knew what he was talking about. He was absolutely sure. That was the one thing that struck me, I think, the most when I started reading Srila Prabhupada's books. I had spent some time when I first arrived in Australia. I'd gotten a Back to Godhead the second day that we arrived there, actually, in Sydney. And then I spent 6 months on a mining camp in northwestern Australia. And I had kept this Back to Godhead, and I would occasionally read it. Then after 6 months, I just felt that I have to go back to Sydney and find these people, you know, and find out more about them. Somehow or another, it didn't quite click, but I knew that what was in the Back to Godhead was very important, and it was talking about things that I could not yet grasp. So I was very attracted to that, that here's some knowledge that's beyond me at the moment. I need to find out more about it. So whilst I was up there in the mining camp, there was one guy from New Zealand. We'd become kind of friendly. He was a real, total Mayavadi and speculator, because I couldn't distinguish at that time. So he'd gone for a 2-week break to Perth, and then he came back to the camp, and then he was raving about this book. I think it was called The First and Last Freedom, again by a well-known Mayavadi so-called guru. And the thing that he was raving about the most was that this guy says that you should be your own guru. Yeah. And when you finish reading this book, you should throw it away, because I'm not your guru, you should be your own guru. And he thought that was a real revelation, right? You read somebody's book and then you throw it away, because now you become your own guru. So I thought, all right, I'll get that book. So I got down to Perth. First thing I did was I went and bought this book. And at that point, my question really was, you know, what is God? It was something that used to annoy me a lot in my speculation. I was kind of figuring out about reincarnation and, you know, being outside of the universe and all these kinds of things. But this question about who is God, what is God, it kept coming into my mind, and it really, really annoyed me. Because in my teenage folly, I had become an atheist. Later on, an adamant atheist also. I used to take a lot of delight in arguing with my mum, who believes in God, but doesn't really have a lot of knowledge. And I would argue with her and defeat her. So I got some pleasure out of that. But later on, just before I went to Australia, I became a bit more reasonable and decided that you can't really prove that there's no God. So even if you can't prove that there is a God, then at least you have to be an agnostic. That would be a more honest position, that I don't know. So that was more or less my situation. So when I got this book in Perth, First and Last Freedom, that was my big question, you know, is there a God? So when I opened it up, I looked through the table of contents to see if there was anything there about God. And there was actually one chapter that asked that question, is there a God? So I went straight to that chapter. I didn't bother with anything else. And the opening paragraph, this man was saying, people sometimes ask me, is there a God? And so I always tell them that if you believe there's a God, then there's a God. And if you don't believe that there's God, then there's no God. So I took his book and followed his advice and I threw it away. I thought, this is completely bogus. I mean, I wasn't a devotee at that time, but even I could understand. If God exists, he exists as an objective reality. It's not a question of whether you believe it or not, because whatever's in your own mind is just, largely nonsense anyway. And it's not a question of whether I believe it or not. Does he actually exist? That's the question. So when I was reading Prabhupada's books, I got the Back to Godhead, that was the one difference that really struck me, that Prabhupada knew what he was talking about. When Prabhupada talked about God, he was very clear, yes, he exists. He's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's omnipresent, and he's a person. And his name is Krishna. And I read that in this Back to Godhead. When I read that, that was it. Immediately all my speculations were finished, as it says there. That which can match all kinds of speculation, agyana bida. It's all speculative knowledge is finished when you get the truth. So Prabhupada was presenting Krishna consciousness as the truth. And as soon as I read that, I just thought that this man really knows what he's talking about. Prabhupada was so clear, so positive, so absolutely certain about everything that he said, that I just realized, now I'm, this is a person who's worthy of being followed. This person actually knows things. So that was it. Then I joined the Sydney Temple. Ajamil was there. He was my first temple commander. He sees God. This is Prabhupada's position. And he had the knowledge to back that up. Just also, I remember when we were in Vrindavan in early December of 1975, I'd just become Prabhupada's servant. So there was some discussion on the morning walk about preaching to the scientists, because Prabhupada used to criticize the material scientists like anything. I don't think there was a single day that went by when Prabhupada didn't say something, to expose them or to criticize them. And they're, of course, the biggest speculators of all, about the nature of the universe and, what we are as living beings and where life comes from and all these different things. So one of the devotees, he mentioned to Srila Prabhupada that the BBT in Sweden were producing a magazine which would be aimed at defeating all the different speculations of the scientists. So, of course, when we heard that, naturally we would have thought that Prabhupada would be very happy to hear that. Yes, do it. But he immediately stopped. He said, don't do it unless you are expert and you can actually defeat them. Otherwise, he said, you will look foolish. He said, I can challenge all the scientists. I'm not a scientist, but I can challenge them because I am convinced on this one point that life cannot come from matter, that life is different from matter. He said, I'm convinced on that one point, and therefore, he said, I can challenge any scientist. So Prabhupada had this ability to suss out all the garbage, all the speculation, all the nonsense that people were speaking, and come right to the essence of the point. What is life? That life is different from matter. It's eternal. And once we understand that, then everything else becomes very clear. So Prabhupada was very confident wherever he traveled. It didn't matter who he met, so-called philosophers, so-called scientists, educationalists, politicians. It didn't matter who they were. Within a couple of minutes, Prabhupada had captured them. He would let them speak. He had a technique. This is a preaching technique. that you ask a couple of questions. Who are you? Where are you from? That immediately makes the person relaxed, that you're interested in them. And what is your idea? Oh, he wants to know about my philosophy. And everybody likes to hear themselves talk. So Prabhupada would make them feel relaxed and friendly, and then let them talk. And then they would start spouting off their philosophies. And as soon as they started speaking, within a few minutes, Prabhupada already knew all the defects, all the deficiencies in their ideas, and then he would start poking them, and he would start telling them, you know, the real philosophy. And then they would sometimes argue, but generally speaking, by the end of the session, they'll be sit there listening, and Prabhupada will be, you know, preaching Krishna consciousness to them, because they had nothing to match it. Yeah, whatever comes out of our minds and intellect is nothing. Yeah, but Prabhupada wasn't talking from his own speculative platform. He was simply presenting the truth as it is, as it's mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam and in the Bhagavad Gita. So that's, you know, real knowledge. This is Vijnana. So I'm just going to finish off the rest of this purport. We've got a few more minutes. So, the highest blunder committed by the impersonalist is to think that when the incarnation of God comes, he accepts a form of matter in the mode of goodness. Actually, the form of Krishna or Narayan is transcendental to any material idea. Even the greatest impersonalist, Shankaracharya, has admitted, Narayana Parovyaktat. The material creation is caused by the avyakta, the impersonal manifestation of matter, or the non-phenomenal total reservoir of pleasure, and Krishna is transcendental to that material conception. This is expressed in the Bhagavatam as Shuddha Sattva, or transcendental. The Lord does not belong to the material mode of goodness, for he is above the position of material goodness. He belongs to the transcendental, eternal status of bliss and knowledge. Dear Lord, the demigods prayed, when you appear in your different incarnations, you take different names and forms according to different situations. Lord Krishna is your name because you are all attractive. You are called Shyamasunda because of your transcendental beauty. Shyam means blackish. Yet they say that you are more beautiful than thousands of cupids, Kandarpa Koti Kamaniya. Although you appear in a color which is compared to that of a blackish cloud, you are the transcendental absolute, and therefore your beauty is many, many times more attractive than the delicate body of Cupid. Sometimes you were called Giridhari because you lifted the hill known as Govardhan. You were sometimes called Nandanandan or Vasudev or Devaki Nandan because you appear as the son of Maharaj Nanda or Devaki or Vasudev. Impersonalists think that your many names or forms are according to a particular type of work and quality because they accept you from the position of a material observer. Our dear Lord, the way of understanding is not to study your absolute nature, form and activities by mental speculation. One must engage himself in devotional service. Then one can understand your absolute nature and your transcendental form, name, and quality. Others may go on speculating for millions of years, but it is not possible for them to understand a single part of your actual position. In other words, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, cannot be understood by the non-devotees because there is a curtain of yoga maya which covers Krishna's actual features. as is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 7.25, Naham Prakasha Sarvasa, Sarvasya. The Lord says, I am not exposed to anyone and everyone. When Krishna came, he was actually present in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and everyone saw him. But not everyone could understand that he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Still, everyone who died in his presence attained complete liberation from material bondage and was transferred to the spiritual world. Because foolish mudhas do not awaken their spiritual nature, they do not understand Krishna or Ram. Avajananti mam mudha manushim tanum ashritam. Even big academic scholars, not considering the endeavors of the acharyas who have recommended devotional service in many elaborate commentaries and notes, think that Krishna is fictitious. This is due to a lack of transcendental knowledge and a failure to awaken Krishna consciousness. One should have the common sense to ask why, if Krishna or Ram were fictitious, then stalwart scholars like Sridhar Swami, Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, Vira Raghava, Vijayadvaj, Vallabhacharya, and many other recognized acharyas would have spent so much time to write about Krishna in notes and commentaries on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, a good point that material, mundane scholars, they like, because that's their nature, they want to outdo every other scholar. Oh, he's written this, now I shall write something a little different, which will explain things in a better way. Why? Because they're after name and fame, because it's all coming from their own minds, and they want people to know, I'm very learned. I can, you know, perform some mental gymnastics better than anybody else. But actually, all the information about Krishna is already given there. There's so many brilliant scholars, Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, the Vira Raghava. Prabhupada used to present his translation of the Bhagavatam after reading the tikas or commentaries of about 15 different acharyas. He had one book, Krishna Shankar Shastri's compilation of commentaries on the Bhagavatam. And wherever Prabhupada traveled, he would have his spiritual master's Bengali commentary, and he would have this Sanskrit edition of all these different acharyas, at least 15 acharyas. And from that, after reading that, then he would compose his own purports. So what we're getting is really, you know, this very refined, and what do you call it, when coffee is filtered, I can't know. Anyway, a very refined presentation of so many different commentaries by realized scholars who have actually understood Krishna in truth. And then Prabhupada was presenting it in his unique way for the people of this age to make us understand the same truths. So if so many great scholars have spent so much time, given up their whole lives, yeah, for presenting this transcendental information, why should we ignore that? Why should we be puffed up and think that we don't need to read those commentaries and we can make our own commentary and then come out with some nonsense that Kurukshetra means the body and the Pandavas mean the five senses, or that when Krishna says, you know, that we have to think of him, it's not to the person Krishna, but it's to the unborn, unknown within, and then just mislead people. This is not scholarship. Scholarship means you take which has already been ascertained to be the truth, and then you can represent it in a suitable way for the person, for the people of your age, but keeping the same truth intact. So that's what Srila Prabhupada was doing. No messing around, no speculation, no filter of his own false ego, yeah, to stop the real truth from coming through. Therefore, Prabhupada called his movement the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Yeah, there were so many gurus that were around at the same time as Srila Prabhupada, the Muktanandas. Yeah, there was that little fat boy that was there, Guru Maharajis. Yeah, and this other rascal, Transcendental Meditation, all advertising themselves. Yeah, putting themselves in the center of attention. But Prabhupada was keeping himself behind and pushing Krishna in front, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And all Prabhupada ever talked about was how wonderful Krishna was. Not about how wonderful he was, or, you know, how wonderful his speculations were, as all these other rascals were doing. Because he was surrendered to Krishna. He knew Krishna was a person. When you understand God is a person and that he knows everything and he's everywhere and he's in control of everything, then what have you got left except to surrender to him? But when you don't accept him as a person, then you can do any nonsense and justify it in any way possible. But when you understand that God is actually a person, you have no choice. You have to surrender if you're going to be in any way honest. So that personal presence of the Supreme Lord can always be felt. Even if we're not, you know, 5,000 years ago when Krishna was personally present on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, when even unqualified people went back to Godhead because of his personal presence. We may not have that. But we have the presence of Krishna in the form of the deity. Prabhupada gave us that. We have Krishna present in every page of the Bhagavatam, not obscured by some mundane calculations and speculations, but deliberately presented in his true glory. So with that advantage, then it's very easy for us to come to this position of transcendence, vijnana, having realized knowledge, knowing that this material world is false, Krishna is the ultimate truth, I am his eternal servant, and my only business is to worship him in various ways. So that's what Srila Prabhupada gave us. That's why he was so effective, because he actually knew the truth. So it's getting a little bit late. We're going to greet the deities at 8:30. Any comments or questions? Ajamil Prabhu. We have another microphone.
Hare Krishna. So you mentioned the point about the commentaries of the other acharyas, and then on one side, and on the other side, there is the the purport of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. And sometimes, just like recently, there was one issue that came up, which is that the commentaries of the acharyas would be quoted to supersede what Srila Prabhupada did. And the example at hand is, for example, the shastras say, and the commentaries say, or the shastras or commentaries say, nobody in this Kali Yuga should take sannyas.
Nobody can what?
Can take sannyas. That nobody's qualified to be sannyas. That no one, that sannyas is forbidden. You know that famous verse. That
yeah.
So Srila Prabhupada superseded that, if you like, and for his ISKCON. So could you comment on that? And the
well, if somebody's looking for references, yeah, I mean, it's okay to go back and look at the works of previous acharyas, but only if you accept them through the funnel that Srila Prabhupada presented. You can't jump over Prabhupada and then use a quote from a previous acharya to disprove something Srila Prabhupada said, because then you're assuming that you know what the meaning of the previous acharya's commentaries were better than Srila Prabhupada himself, which is a ludicrous proposal. So we have to see what other acharyas have spoken through the vehicle of Srila Prabhupada. Then everything becomes very clear. Otherwise, I mean, there's obviously room for speculation at any moment. You can read, you know, I remember at least when I first joined in Sydney in 1972. There were one or two devotees that had discovered the writings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So they started reading those and they started interpreting them. And then they started criticizing some of the practices that we were doing in the temple. Because, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said this or said that. So that's, what's it called? I forget the Sanskrit term. Jumping over your own guru. Assuming that your guru doesn't know or understand the writings of the previous acharyas. So that becomes a big offense. What is that, Guru Maharaj? Yes, I can't hear it clearly. I've forgotten the Sanskrit. Say it.
Actually, I wanted to make a commentary.
You'll say that first.
Maryavada Vyatikrama.
All right, very good. So we have to be very careful not to jump over one's own guru. Then your spiritual life is finished. And we've seen some examples of Prabhupada's own disciples get a little bit of learning. There was one rascal in 1976. He had been a BBT editor. He'd learnt some Bengali, a little Sanskrit. He was Prabhupada's personal servant on different occasions. And then in 1976, he rejected Srila Prabhupada and even wrote a letter to him saying that most of, you know, the teachings in ISKCON are different from or even the opposite of what's actually in the Shastra. Yeah, such a rascal. Prabhupada made that comment. You get a little bit of learning, oh, now you've become a big man. That's Mayavad. There's a story that Bhavananda used to tell about. They were on a morning walk here in Mayapur, and there was some like ditch, some embankment that they had to go down. So Bhavananda held his hand out, Prabhupada took a hold of it to steady himself, and he went down the embankment. Then when he got to the bottom, then he very vigorously pushed Bhavananda's arm away, and it was so kind of violent, not exactly violent, but vigorous, that everybody was surprised. And then Prabhupada said, "This is the Mayavadi. I take your help. You are my guru. I take your help. And then when I'm fixed up enough, then I become guru and I don't need you anymore." So this is the problem. Yeah, we have to be very, very careful not to jump over the previous acharyas. Yes, Prabhu.
Actually, this is the first time I heard about this important detail of Prabhupada reading all these 15 acharyas' commentaries on Bhagavatam, plus his Guru Maharaj in proper of an acharya. But he brought to me this analysis, though, where we see sometimes Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Yuga Avatar, not being even recognized, duly recognized by other of the other three Vaishnava Sampradayas. But those who follow Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can understand how he condensed the other acharyas' philosophy in Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. The similar things happen with His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Many people think that he gave the ABC. This information that you gave is so important because technically what he was doing, so compassionate, so mercifully, was giving us the essence. Mahaprabhu went directly to the essence also. Nobody could understand that Western Vaishnavas or aspirant Vaishnavas and myself could attempt to understand the ultimate message of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the ultimate degree of Rasa Tattva. That's why Srila Prabhupada is actually, when we understand not only reading his book, but studying his book, he deserves the title of Rasikacharya too. Thank you so much for this information.
All right. It's very late. They're just about to open the deities, so thank you all very much. Sri Sri Krishna Janmastami Ki. Srila Prabhupada Ki. Go, Premanand.